What makes a place a great place to work? According to our guest this hour, it's neither the paycheck nor the perks, but it's something deeper. Does the workplace meet our basic psychological needs? Does yours? How can it do that? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We will talk with the author of The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. And we want to know if you are working in such a place. And we'll talk about how you or your management can make your workplace better. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Ron Friedman, an award-winning psychologist and expert on human motivation. He's the founder of Ignite 80, a consulting firm that helps business leaders build productive workplaces. He contributes to the blogs of the Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, Forbes, and Psychology Today. And he is the author of The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So a Gallup survey reported just last week that U.S. employees are mostly not engaged in their work. Only 31% reported feeling engaged. Why do you think so many of us are not engaged in our jobs?
Well, I think the focus for a lot of organizations has been for years about giving people things that they think will make them happy at work, like fancy titles or a higher salary or maybe some of the fancy perks that we're seeing in Silicon Valley. But the reality is what people want from their workplace is ultimately the same thing they want in every other domain in life, and that's to have their basic human psychological needs fulfilled. So if you're looking to create a great workplace, what you want to do is make sure that people feel like they are growing their competence on a daily basis, feeling like they're connected to their colleagues in a meaningful way, and feeling autonomous in the way that they do their work. So it's competence, relatedness, and autonomy. And when we have those basic human psychological needs met, we're happier, healthier, and more productive.
Well, that sounds good, and we'll go into some detail in just a moment. But is that to say that most workplaces are not doing this?
Well, I think what's really interesting is that there are some very easy and useful techniques that any organizations can apply to make people feel more autonomous, competent, and related, but they're just not doing them. And the reason they're not doing them is because there's all this research that's been done in academic journals that managers simply aren't aware of. And it's not for a lack of effort. You know, everybody's interested in creating a great workplace, particularly in the last decade or so, where it's become more prominent, this idea that when people are happier, they're more productive at work and they're more loyal to their organization. But the trouble is that most managers aren't aware of the research, and that's, in fact, why I wrote the book. Is I wrote The Best Place to Work to give people an inside look at what science has uncovered on how we can all be happier and more productive at work.
Mm-hmm. So what is it that we need to be doing in our workplaces, or what do our workplaces need to be doing with us to make sure that we are growing our competence?
Well, you know, there's some really easy things to make sure that this happens. First of all, it's the recognition of this idea that in order for us to be at our most passionate about our jobs, we need to have growth experiences. And typically the trajectory at most organizations is the opposite of that. When you first join an organization and you're learning about a new job, it's quite challenging for the first few months, maybe even the first couple of years, but then it becomes predictable and it's kind of the same thing over and over again, and that's when people lose interest and become bored and less engaged. So if you're looking to engage people, you really want to make sure that they're constantly growing their competence. And so here are some easy things that any company can do. One is consider offering your employees a reading budget. So maybe it's once a quarter or once a month, everybody at your company can buy a book that of their choosing that is in some way relevant to their job. And what that does is it gives people an opportunity to learn new things about their profession, about their jobs that they can then incorporate into their role at work, and it gets them feeling like they're learning new things. A similar idea is encouraging people on the job to look at industry blogs so that, again, they're exposed to some new ideas that they can then incorporate. And then finally, just generally inviting people to propose some courses that they can take that enable them to grow their skills. And the interesting thing about this isn't something you do simply to get people interested in their job or, you know, just to be a nice manager. It's ultimately that something that you do to pay dividends in the long term for your company, because the more engaged people are, the less likely they are to turn over.
Yeah. So can my company, like, send me to Hawaii for a training conference?
You know, that would be lovely, wouldn't it? But it doesn't need to be that lavish. You know, simply, you know, if you have, for example, if you're interested in, you know, I don't know, maybe listening to a course from some other radio hosts in your case, although I'm sure you're far beyond that. But if you were interested in something like that, perhaps there's a conference that's taking place nearby that isn't all that expensive. Maybe it just involves you driving down to it for the day. And so, you know, we need to, I think, break out of this mentality of how much is this costing me in the short term, because the better question is how much is this saving me in the long run by not having someone like Joy, who's been a loyal employee for all these years, turn over, and then I have to go find someone, and then I have to train them, and then I don't know that they're going to be quite as effective as Joy has been. So I think it's that mentality of this is an investment that's going to pay money for me and grow my business in the long term that is what differentiates some of those companies on the top lists from some of the average organizations.
And isn't there, though, I don't know, some employees who think, hey, I've got enough to do, I don't need to be reading another book or checking out, you know, taking a course to do even more on my job?
Well, yes, of mm-hmm. course. And certainly we have to recognize the fact that we're overburdened more so today than any other time, in part because of the inundation of information. We're constantly bombarded with emails and meeting requests and conference calls. And so what I'm arguing in the book is, if you look at the research, if you want people to be engaged, you have to create opportunities for that to happen in a reasonable fashion, which means cutting down on some of the other things because it's a long-term investment. Now, from the employee perspective, the thing to remember is we're more passionate about our job when we're learning and growing new things. So rather than perceiving it as something that you're doing that's extra, view it as something that's essential to your work, because it's not just something you're doing to be better at your job today. It's something that's going to position you to get a better position in the future.
Yeah, so let's talk about meeting our basic psychological needs by our workplaces allowing us to connect with others in a meaningful way. What does that mean?
Well, we have a basic human need for relatedness. We need to feel connected to the people around us. And when we do, we're more effective. And, you know, when we think about colleague relationships at work, we often think about the negatives. We think about gossip or favoritism or people fooling around, but that's exactly the wrong way to think about it. When you look at the research, people are a lot more effective when they feel respected and they feel like they have close connections than they're supported, and it's for some basic logistical reasons. One is, if I feel like I fit in within my company, I can pay less attention to whether or not people respect me and more attention to doing my actual work. I also am more willing to ask for help when I need it, and I'm more likely to tell my colleagues when they're off on the wrong path. And so now I'm a lot more likely to be effective in my role because I feel connected. And so how, as an organization, can you make sure that people have these relationships? And in many cases, organizations kind of leave it to chance. You know, you provide people with materials they need to do their jobs and maybe a fair salary and all of these things that are basic, but then when it comes down to relationships, that's something that organizations say, well, I guess that's out of my control. I hope these people get along. Mm-hmm. And what I point to in the book is that there are some specific things you can do by learning from the psychology of friendship. For one thing, when you bring someone on, don't just introduce them by their professional experience or their CV. Talk about some of their interests outside of work. So, for example, here's Joy. Joy likes to bake cupcakes on the weekends, and she likes to play volleyball on Tuesday nights. And so now, if I am working with you on a project, I can talk to you about my interest in volleyball or my interest in baking cupcakes, and we have something to connect on that isn't just a work-related matter. And it's ultimately those relationships that are formed around non-work matters that are the closest employee friendships. And so encouraging people to talk about their personal lives and giving them opportunities to do that in a natural way that doesn't feel forced, it's not an icebreaker, that can help Another thing is to create opportunities for those conversations to happen by investing in informal social spaces. So organizations spend a lot of time thinking about what their conference room is going to look like and what their what the entryway mm-hmm. is going to look like, but they don't think all that much about those informal social spaces like picnic tables outside or investing in a cafe like in a kitchen, right? A lot of those conversations at work are happening in the kitchen, not at the conference room. So creating some of those informal social spaces for people to naturally bond, that can be helpful as well.
And I can bake my cupcakes in those in that kitchen.
Well, and with one stone.
And the third thing that workplaces should do is make sure that employees have a choice in how we do our job. That sounds good. So why is that so helpful?
Well, again, it's a basic need. We need to feel like it's our choice to engage in the behaviors that we're doing. And in some ways, that's a tricky one because, you know, the reality is in a lot of companies, you don't have a lot of choice. You know, you need people to do a particular job. But what I'm arguing in The Best Place to Work and in bringing in some of the research is that rather than telling people, here are the three things I need you to do on Tuesday, identify what the goals are and then invite your employees to figure out what the process is for themselves, because then they're more invested in doing the work because they have had a part in it. And another easy thing that you can do is when you present a task, don't just talk about how the work should be done. Talk about why the work is being done. You know, managers often assume that employees have the same level of understanding or the same level of information around the rationale for the work. But oftentimes that's just not the case because they are not privy to the same meetings. They don't have all the same information. So spending a little time at the beginning of a project to say, here's why the work you're about to do is going to bring value to the department, to the company. And that level of understanding can, again, really help people's experience of choice and make them more motivated to do a good job.
So does your workplace help you do that? Does it help you grow your competence? Does it help you to connect with others in a meaningful way? Does it give you a choice on how you do your job? Our guest is saying that these are the attributes of the best places to work. And we wonder if you agree or not. We wonder if you have any questions. And we wonder if you work in a great place, or did you ever work in a great place? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Do you like your workplace? And if so, what makes it so good? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking with Ron Friedman, who is a psychologist and the author of The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. And we wonder if you work in an extraordinary workplace and what makes it extraordinary. We welcome any examples you might have or any questions you might have at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. So our guest is saying that it's not so much the perks or the paycheck that make workplaces great. It's whether or not the workplace meets our basic psychological needs. And I'm wondering, though, Ron Friedman, boy, I would love to work at a place that had a gym and free yoga classes and paid me a lot of money to get my job done, maybe fed me great food in the cafeteria. Can these perks help meet our psychological needs?
Yeah, I think they certainly can. And I think there's certainly a place for perks. You know, having access to free meals over the course of the day, being able to exercise, maybe even being able to nap. You see a lot of these companies that are on the Best Place to Work list are offering access to restoration rooms where people can go and take a nap or do yoga or stretch. And I think that the reason that those benefits are useful is because they position us to do our best work. So it's not that those benefits shouldn't be thought about or even or implemented. It's that they're not a substitute for feeling competent or for feeling connected to others. So if you go into work and you don't know anyone, and you're forced to do a particular set of tasks every Tuesday, and you have access to a nap room, you're not going to be happy at your job. You first need to have those psychological needs, and then to the extent that those perks exist and are layered above the basic human needs that we have, they can certainly be beneficial. And I'm all for giving people some of those great benefits. And I think it's because that they enable us to do our job more effectively.
Well, we have Tyler on Facebook who says, I would be happy with any job where I felt the boss was competent and the pay and benefits were fair for the work. Having some trouble finding this. Also, I suppose that friendly coworkers would really help. Nothing is worse than people who create meaningless drama in the workplace. Well, there's a number of things to talk about here, I suppose. Putting the pay in, let's talk a little bit about the pay and benefits first. Mm-hmm. He wants them to be fair for the work. I mean, we may, if we have our psychological needs met, but we're still not getting the amount of pay we think we should be getting for the work we're doing, are we going to be happy?
Yeah, let me be clear. I am not saying that you should not pay your employees a fair wage. In fact, there's reason to think that paying people a little bit above the industry average is a very wise investment. Because if, for example, you make $50,000 a year and I decide I'm going to pay you $53,000, that's going to lead to a boost in loyalty and a boost in motivation. And so it's only costing me $3,000. You're going to be more loyal to me as a company because now I've paid you a little bit extra. And it's the signal that it sends, which is that I value you as a person and I think that you're worth a little bit more than whatever someone else is willing to pay you. Whereas if you think about the contrast, if I give you $47,000 and now I'm slightly underpaying you, I may be saving $3,000, but that $3,000 is not a good idea from the perspective of now you feel slighted, you feel like, hey, this employer is taking advantage of me. So I'm from a psychological perspective, we need to feel like we're being treated respectfully and fairly, and we're not going to be performing at our best if we feel like we're underpaid.
Mm-hmm. And talk some about, you say that our employers should help us connect with others and coworkers in a meaningful way. Would that then cut down on the workplace drama that Tyler is experiencing?
You know, in some ways, I think it actually would. If you think about why people gossip, they gossip because they feel like they get some additional information about other people that helps them in a way that they might not otherwise be able to be quite as effective. So, for example, if I know, let's say Tyler and I are working together, and I hear a rumor that Tyler is really flunking this project that he's working on, that gives me useful information that the next time I'm working with Tyler on a project, maybe I might be a little bit more assertive in how we do the work rather than leaving it up to Tyler. And so, there's a level of intelligence that's gained by having gossip. But to the extent that people feel like they can be transparent with one another, there's less of a need for gossip. So gossip is in part something that happens, if you look at the research, it's something that happens when people feel like they don't have all the information they need, and so they engage in these activities that give them more insight into the behaviors of others. So when we have the closeness between one another, when we feel like we can be open with one another, we're actually less likely to gossip.
Yeah. So how important is a competent boss or supervisor?
Oh, it's vital. Anybody who's seen an episode of The Office knows that it's very difficult to stay motivated when you feel like the people in charge don't know what they're doing. And, I talk a lot in the book about how the behaviors of people at the top really set the tone for a company culture. Company culture is not about your mission or your vision statement or the words you put up on the wall. It's ultimately about how people at the top behave. And the reason for that is because when we look at the people in positions of authority for a signal on what the social norms are, how we should behave, and when we don't have confidence at the people at the top, we just are not, it's just very difficult to stay motivated in working for that company.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Ron Friedman, who is the author of The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. We welcome your questions, your examples, your experiences. Do you work in a great place? What makes it great? Do you agree with what you're hearing, some of the important things a workplace can do to make you happy, a more productive worker? Let's go to Tom in Cedarburg first. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for having me on. I'm glad that the issue of wages and pay was brought up. That's, that was something I was going to mention. The other thing is that I've noticed since the drop in unions that a lot of all of these private bosses are, how can I put it, mean and cruel to people, I think. Not all, but there are some that are, and with the, especially the non-union environment, and it makes the worker a lot more cutthroat against each other and more competitive and against each other and wanting to destroy each other and, you know, to snitch on people. And it doesn't make a good work environment, especially when people are not making much money. The ideas that you're, I guess, they're speaking about really, to me, really apply to the top percent of the working force. The regular working people are just, you know, looking to be treated kindly by their boss and their coworkers and to, you know, make it a livable wage and living.
Yeah, so are these ideas really for, I don't know, mostly white-collar workers or, you know, the top 1%, as Tom was kind of alluding to?
You know, I think that there's a greater awareness in those industries, particularly in tech industries, that treating employees well benefits the company's bottom line. But more and more companies are starting to realize it, and I'm optimistic that the data supports this in a way that is going to open the eyes of employers, even for those in blue-collar jobs and other industries where the current awareness just isn't where it should be. We have data that I talk about in the book that shows that when people are happier at their job, they're more creative, they're more productive, they provide greater customer satisfaction, because if you're happier at your job, then that emotional spillover then impacts the way that your customers view your company. The happy employees are less likely to quit, they're less likely to call in sick, and in fact, if you look at the stock returns of the companies on the Best Place to Work list, their stock returns outperformed the market as a whole by a stunning factor of 2-1. So what I'm hopeful that more organizations are going to start to realize is, regardless of what the industry they're in is that investing in the workplace doesn't cost them money. It's something that helps them ensure that they're making more money in the long term.
Next we'll go to Mark in Waukesha. Hello, Mark.
Yeah, good morning. Just calling in regards to the impact it has on hiring or having bosses that are really competent and know what they're doing. I worked for the state of Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and last 4 years we've seen morale take a huge, huge dip. And the main reason for that is that the people who are appointed into leadership of the DNR are basically politicians. And when you're led by people who don't know what your mission is or what your job is or where you're going, and on top of that, they abuse their responsibilities.
Yeah, you know what, Mark? I do appreciate the example you're sharing, but I'm afraid it's going to kind of divert us into an area where our guest isn't really sure about the politics of Wisconsin's DNR. But maybe just generally, Ron Friedman, the boss is a political hack, and everybody else wants to save the environment. They don't have a shared mission, I think, is where Mark was going.
You know, it's interesting. It makes me think about the research on how we decide what position someone is going to have in a company. In other words, when we decide to hire someone, how do we determine if that person is effective in that role? And typically, the tool that most organizations use is the in-person interview. And as it turns out, when you look at the research, hiring people based on in-person interviews turns out to be a terrible method of predicting their performance. And in part, it's because of all of these biases that we have when we interview someone. There's research showing that if someone is good-looking, we tend to view them as being more competent than they actually are. If someone is taller, we view them as having greater leadership ability. And if someone has a deeper voice, we view them as being more trustworthy than they actually are. And it's, you know, all of these sorts of biases then impact at the questions that we ask in the interview. So, for example, if I have someone who's interviewing who's tall and good-looking and has a deeper voice, I might say, tell me about your management experience. Whereas if I view someone as being perhaps more introverted or not quite as well suited for the role, I might ask a slightly different question, which is, have you had leadership experiences in the past? Both of those questions get at the same topic, but the way I frame the question then impacts the answer that I get, which then serves as a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so what I argue is a better method of determining whether someone's going to be a good manager is not just doing the in-person interview and then hiring someone who happens to do well in answering interpersonal questions, but giving them, having them do an audition for the role, where you give them a project that involves the skills you're looking for, that's job relevant, and then evaluating them on their performance on that task. And there are all sorts of activities you can provide a potential manager with doing, like asking them how they would go about getting their team motivated or what they would do to allocate the different roles that are involved in getting the project done. And that will provide you a much better insight into hiring a person who's going to be effective in the role rather than relying on a technique that has far outlived its usefulness.
Talk some about how important it is for the boss and the workers to have a shared vision, to have a communicated mission, and all be on the same page on fulfilling that mission.
I mean, I think it's clearly valuable. If you have people on a team who don't see the same path or don't see the value of performing a shared mission, they're just not going to be as effective or cohesive. And really, it's something that I think speaks to the need that we all have for doing the work in a choiceful manner. So feeling like we're doing it not because our manager sees value in it, but because we ourselves see value in it ourselves. And that's why it's so critical to make sure that you're asking some of those open-ended questions and providing the rationale for why the work is being done, and then also inviting your employees to share in how the process is being designed. And, you know, it's all of those tiny techniques that aren't particularly expensive or time-consuming, but can lead to a completely different product at the end of the day, because now people are invested in doing the work on a completely different level.
Yeah. You know, we should maybe talk a little bit, while we're on this subject, maybe the workplace mission or goal or is you don't share it. And maybe then you don't belong there.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. It's something that we need to think more deeply about when we select the jobs that we select. You know, we think about the things that are useful to us in the short term. So having a higher salary, having a good title, being part of a company that is solvent, all of those things are important to us when we think about the job. We also think about what's available to us, right? What can we get? But what I think people would be better suited to do is to think about not just how much is this company going to pay me or can I get this job, but to think about, is the job going to help me feel competent? It's going to grow my competence. It's going to help me feel connected to my colleagues. Is it going to help me do my job in an autonomous way? And to really look for jobs that help them fulfill their needs in a way that makes them happier, not just from those sorts of things that we are accustomed to looking for, but also helps them grow in a meaningful way, because then they'll be a lot more passionate in their job.
Let's go next to Matt in Ellsworth. Hello, Matt.
Hi, Joy. Hey, Ron. I drive a truck, and it's like the best job ever, because you can have whatever you want on the radio, simple tasks. You don't have a big brother watching over you all the time. I made really good money. The hours are long and it's sedentary, but after work I can go and run, after work. You can take a nap if you want to. You can pack a lunch if you'd like, or you can stop at a restaurant, wherever you can get a truck into. And my wife works at an office, and like similar to Tyler's post, I mean, there's gossip, there's backbiting, it's a nightmare. And like I said, this job, I could talk to you guys in the morning, or I could talk to other friends, and it's just, like I said, it's really freeing. All I got to do is just do your work and make sure it gets done. I work for a great company, and And yeah, the only bad part is if there's bad roads and bad traffic. So
Matt, I was going to say thank you for choosing us to keep you company this morning, and I hope the roads are okay.
Yeah, they're good. I'm on 29 right now. It's a little bit. Oh, and the other good point about driving a truck is that if you don't like the company you work for, there's so many jobs in the trucking industry that there's literally, I literally changed companies a few months ago where you can stop for one company one day and then start the next, like the next day.
There's a lot of demand for your skill. And I was going to say too, that there are some truck drivers who I think are, you know, they're self-employed, they're owner operators or whatever. So, sounds like Matt found the perfect job for him, Ron Friedman.
It certainly does. And, you know, I think Matt raises a really critical point, which is that passion about a job or engagement about a job isn't necessarily about the task that we're doing. It's about the conditions that we build around it. And when you fulfill people's psychological needs, really any activity can become a passion. So here Matt's talking about how he has autonomy and how he does his work. He obviously feels competent about doing it, and he feels connected to others because even though you and I might view being a truck driver as fairly isolating, he finds a way to stay in touch with his friends over the course of the day and call into radio shows and meet new people. So I think it really highlights how any activity can become a passion if we build the right conditions around it.
And what about studies that have found that many workers are more productive when they have the option to work from home? So, you know, I mean, your workplace could be a truck or it could be your home. How does that play into this?
Yeah, in the book I talk a lot about the research on telecommuting and how, in fact, when you allow people the flexibility to do their work when and where they would like to do it, because that plays into people's feeling of autonomy and also allows them to be more competent. So, for example, if I know that I'm going to be a lot more effective working from home between the hours of 7 and 11, and then I can drive into work and avoid traffic at 11:30, now I'm better able to use my best hours to doing my job, whereas for other people, you know, they're after 2 o'clock, they're really checked out. You know, you're exhausted after lunch and really not being all that effective. So rather than requiring employees to stay at the office because it's not yet 5 o'clock, why not give them the flexibility to choose how they spend their hours to the extent that that's an option? And there's research showing that people who have flexibility over their how they spend their time, when and where they work, they tend to be more significantly more engaged than people that have no flexibility and they're required to be at the office between the hours of 9 and 5. Now, that said, people who are telecommuting full-time, they're less engaged than the people who have flexibility. And the reason for that is because they don't feel as strong of a connection to their colleagues. They don't have that opportunity to mingle and to talk about personal matters and to have those psychological needs fulfilled. So the key takeaway here is rather than feeling like your employees are going to be more effective because they're at the office and you're monitoring them full-time, providing them with that added flexibility to choose when and where they work actually leads to greater outcomes in the sense of more loyalty and greater performance benefits as well.
We'll talk more about what makes a place a great place to work, according to our guest, Ron Friedman, who is author of The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. He says it's not just the paycheck or the perks. He says that workplaces need to meet our basic psychological needs to truly be a great place. What do you think? What questions do you have? Do you think you work at a great place? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about how our management can make our workplaces better with the author of The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. If you have any questions or some examples, maybe you want to brag about your place. Do you work at a great place? What's so great about it? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Our guest is Ron Friedman. He's a psychologist and an expert on human motivation. What about, Ron, if I don't know, if we don't have our workplace is not necessarily meeting our basic psychological needs. It's not helping us grow our competence. It's not helping us connect with others in a meaningful way. It's not giving us autonomy on how we do our job. How do workers advocate for if our needs are not being met?
Well, I think that there are a number of things that any employee can do to be happier at their job today. The one thing is to start viewing your job as not just something that is handed down to you from a manager, but start looking at yourself as a job co-creator. And what I mean by that is identify tasks that you really love doing and then proactively find ways of doing more of them. Come up with a plan on how you can spend more of your time doing those things and approach your manager and propose it and say, here's the business case for why I think if I do more of this, we'll be more successful, and here's a plan for how we can achieve that. So identifying some of the things you really enjoy doing and do more of them. The other thing is to look for learning opportunities, and we talked about reading more books and reading industry blogs. We're really more passionate about our job when we feel more challenged and more having those growth opportunities. So increasing the variety of tasks that we do, looking for ways of changing that, rather than just simply doing a job because we have, you know, we've had it handed down to us by a manager. I think looking at ourselves as being someone who directs the work that we do can be helpful. And I think, you know, one of the challenges that a lot of employees have is that they are stuck with a manager who maybe isn't willing to consider some of these ideas. And one of the recommendations I make is start a book club. Talk to your fellow colleagues about starting a book club, maybe over lunch one day, and invite your manager. And I think you're going to be viewed as someone who is proactively thinking about new ways of doing the work. And choose a book. Doesn't have to be this one. Could be any book. But when the nice thing is, when you're all reading a book together and some of the ideas pop up about how you can improve your workplace, it's no longer you who's suggesting it or taking it to your manager and say, hey, I think we should provide everybody with a reading budget. Now the book says it, and you can all talk about it as a group. So it's kind of a third-party endorsement for ideas that can then be discussed with your management team.
Yeah, and you're also being a little more social with your coworkers when you
exactly.
have that book club. Yeah.
Exactly. And it's an easy thing to do. And, you know, there are some companies that I talk about in the book about that have this you don't have to read the book club, where it's the duty of one person on the team to summarize what has been learned, and then everybody can still discuss it. So if you're worried about your colleagues not reading the book, that's okay, because, again, the ideas are still being presented, and now they're being talked about in your company and potentially being incorporated.
And no gossiping about that coworker who's not reading the book. Michelle in Milwaukee is with us. Hello, Michelle.
Hi. My question was just around, actually, very related to what you're just talking about. Have you ever come across organizations that have involved employees, new employees, in writing their own job description and perhaps rewriting that job description as they progress in the role?
Rewriting your own job description.
Yeah, that, you know, in fact, I think that's the direction that we're all headed. And I think it is more than anything else a mindset shift. So for generations, we have come into work, and managers have told us what to do, and we've been happy to do that job. But just flipping that switch and just turning around and giving yourself permission to think about ways that you can improve the quality of the work that you do by having more input into how that work is being done, and then proactively talking to your manager about doing X, Y, and Z more often, not only are the chances, I think, fairly solid that you'll actually get a response, but even if it doesn't work out, you're now viewed as someone who's proactive about thinking ways of improving the company's performance and improving the department's performance. So taking that risk and saying, here are some things that I think I'd be a lot more better suited to do. Here's how I think we can still get the work done at the end of the day. What do you think about this? I think that's a conversation worth having.
Ryan on Facebook says that what makes a place a great place to work, he says, just feeling like you are important at the workplace, and also that you get an honest day's pay for an honest day's work. But what about that feeling of respect and importance?
I think it's critical. I think recognition is critical. And, you know, in the book I talk about this comparison to video games. And how is it that video games keep us engaged the way they do? If you think about what we do when we're playing a game like Tetris, for example, not particularly exciting. We're sorting falling blocks, but yet many of us spend hours or days or, you know, weekends playing games that don't necessarily involve the most engaging activities. And in part, the reason that video games are so interesting to many of us is because they provide many of the conditions that we desperately seek at work. They provide us with instant feedback on whether or not we're doing a good job. We get recognition when we have developed a new skill, we move on to the next board. And then they have that progressive difficulty. So video games get harder the longer you play them rather than easier, which is the opposite of most jobs. And so finding ways to recognize people more frequently is critical. You know, a lot of companies offer feedback at 6-month or 12-month intervals in the performance review. And this is not a recipe for engagement because oftentimes you're getting that feedback in a way that feels like it's coming out of left field because it has been so infrequent. So it's not all that useful. So better, I think, to have a company culture where recognition doesn't just come from a manager, but it's coming from fellow employees at more regular intervals. So one thing you can do is, if you're a manager, is at the start of every meeting, think about someone you want to recognize for having done a good job on something specific. And then start the meeting by recognizing that person and then moving on to what you're actually, the crux of the meeting. And if you do that often enough, what you'll notice is that the employees start to mimic that behavior. It's not just the manager who's giving compliments or recognizing people, but the recognition is coming from fellow employees. And the more that happens, the more engaged the workplace is going to become.
But do you run the risk of, you know, I don't know, boss's pet if somebody's getting singled out and complimented all the time by the boss?
You're referring to having the manager
point out something,
over and over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's something you got to be mindful of as a manager, to think about giving people due respect for a job well done and being specific, not about the person, but about what they did that was so impressive. So, for example, if you have a presentation on a team, rather than saying to someone, "Good job, Mike, on that presentation," you can say something along the lines of, "I really appreciate all the research you put in ahead of our conversation with the client." And so now it's not about Mike, it's about the behavior, and everyone can learn from that and apply to the way that they do their work.
Andy emails, "I would love to get your guest's opinion on the changing attitude towards the workplace held by millennials. What's working and what's not?" I guess I'm curious on that too, because we've heard that millennials do want, I don't know, a different type of workplace atmosphere than aging baby boomers like me.
Well, I think that there are differences across generation without question, but ultimately I think that those differences are more attributable to differences in where people are in the course of their lifespan rather than where they are in what year they were born. So in other words, you as a baby boomer are more likely to have different priorities than someone who's 20 or 30. So when you're in your 20s or 30s, you're more interested in learning new things and building your skill set. When you're in your 50s and 60s, you're more interested in job security. Now, ultimately, what makes both people in both camps happy is having their psychological needs met. And there's research, there's thousands of studies showing that these are basic needs that we have regardless of our age. While I do think that there are some differences that we can point to and say, hey, this is different and this is different, ultimately, if you're looking to have the happiest workplace possible and the most productive workplace possible, look for ways of providing autonomy, competence, and relatedness across age groups, and I think that you're going to be more successful in the long term.
Let's go to Rick and Hurley now. Hello, Rick.
Hi. Great show. Great guest. Programs like this make life better. So,
thank you, Rick.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rick.
This is about temporary services, and two things about temporary services and minimum wage and how that affects how people feel valued. And it's an expendable workforce out there, and the people who are hiring, they know that. And I see that happening so much where the temporaries are just being taken advantage of. They don't feel like they have a future, and it's just a rotating door. And I'm just wondering if your guest has any comments on that. I will be buying the book. I had to step away earlier, so I might have missed anything about temp services.
No, we didn't talk about temp services. Anything to add about that, Ron?
Well, I think, first of all, thank you, Rick, for the kind words. What I would say is that I think that, again, this is an area where more managers need to be aware of the data, and it's just not the case right now. Most people don't have the information. And I think back to years ago when the book Moneyball came out and how that revolutionized sports. At the time, more sports organizations, more baseball teams felt like they had to look for home run hitters because that's what was going to lead to more wins for their team. But then they looked at the data and they realized, you know what, it's not home run hitters that gets us wins. Rather, it's on-base percentage. So it's having players who take walks and who hit singles. That's what contributes more to a winning formula. And I think here I'm hopeful that this book will offer something that's similar in the sense that we need to recognize that it's not about salary or positions, but rather keep giving people the conditions they need to work more effectively. So even if you're hiring a temp, to the extent that you're offering them those basic psychological needs, they're going to be more productive in the long term. And frankly, there are benefits to having long-term employees that far exceed having a temp, because now they're going to be more committed to your company, and that can lead to profit lower training requirements for an organization. And so I'm hopeful that will open people's eyes to the benefits of treating employees well, because the extent that you treat your employees well, they're going to treat your company well as well.
Sharon works in a great place. She emails, "I work as a human resource coordinator for a great company. The management is competent, and they are constantly praising their workers when a job is well done. In addition to this, they offer tuition reimbursements and encourage the workers to further our educations. They also, like your guest mentioned, was important, don't dictate my day-to-day tasks. I understand what the objective is, and they don't care how I get there as long as I complete the job. They also do things like have lunch parties for employees. The company makes me feel like I am a smart, important member of the team. I want to work there, Ron."
As well you should. It sounds like they're doing everything right.
And frankly, Wisconsin Public Radio does a lot of things right, too, so I'm very fortunate. Any takeaway for our listeners in terms of what do we need to do to try to make our workplaces the best workplaces?
You know, one thing we haven't talked about is the importance of restocking your mental energy outside of work hours. And so being great at your job and being really attaining top performance is no longer about what you do just between the hours of 9 and 5. It's also about what you as an employee do outside of work hours, and giving yourself that opportunity to take some breaks when you get home. And job satisfaction is also related to how often you exercise, how much of your time you spend outdoors. Training yourself to disconnect after hours by turning off your cell phone and really being able to pay attention to your family. And we see more and more organizations encouraging their employees to really turn off their work mode and go into home mode when they're outside of the office. And it's because we're a lot better at focusing at our jobs when we have that freedom and flexibility to recharge our battery on the weekends and in the evenings.
Well, this has been motivational. Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ron Friedman is the author of The Best Place to Work, The Art and Science of Creating an Extraordinary Workplace. Thanks to Christy Taylor and to Caleb Lado for producing this hour. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. Tomorrow at this time, we are going to talk with a Wisconsin couple who lost their family farm almost 30 years ago. And we'll talk about where their life is now and how they got to where they are now, coming up tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.